Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the LSE for this event, which is hosted by the Department of International Relations. My name is Jeffrey Schweroth. I am the head of the International Relations Department and also a professor of international relations. And I'm extremely pleased to welcome you here in the audience today in the theater, as well as those who are joining us online. First, if I may, a few housekeeping items before we start the event this evening. We aren't expecting a fire alarm tonight, so if one is heard, please do make your way out of the building calmly and follow our stewards and event staff in the audience. May I also ask you that you please turn your mobiles on silent for the duration of the event. Tonight's event is a lecture delivered by Marwa Dowdy, held in honor of the renowned scholar Fred Halliday. This lecture will explore the entanglement of colonialism and capitalism and environmental exploitation that has shaped the modern global order in ways that continue to structure global inequality. Mainstream approaches in international relations often obscure the violent histories of dispossession, domination, and extractive economies that drive contemporary political and ecological crises, thus producing racialized geographies of land, resources, labor, and environment that continue to endure. Drawing on Fred Halliday's critique of narratives that portray the Arab world as inherently locked in conflict, economic failure, or cultural clashes, tonight's lecture will situate climate and human vulnerabilities within the region's settler colonial, extractivist, or war-torn past and present in contexts such as Algeria, Palestine, and Syria. Then following this evening's lecture, we will be pleased to host a reception in celebration of what would have been Fred Halliday's 80th birthday, recognizing his enduring contribution to the department and the field of international relations, and we invite you to join us afterwards at that celebration. Now I would be pleased to introduce tonight's panel. Our speaker this evening is Marwa Dowdy. She was an associate professor of international relations and the Seif Gobash Chair in Arab Studies at the Center for Contemporary Arab Studies, the School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University. Her last book, The Origins of the Syrian Conflict, Climate Change and Human Security, received the prestigious Harold and Margaret Sprout Prize from the International Studies Association. She is currently writing a book on climate justice in the Arab world, which calls for a rethinking of security as justice. In this book, she will argue that modernity, global capitalism, and environmental destruction and epistemic erasure remain inseparable from colonial legacies and global capitalism that favor new forms of ecocide and green colonialism in the Arab world. We are also pleased to be joined this evening by my colleague, Jasmine Ghani, who is an assistant professor in international relations theory at the LSE. She specializes in anti-colonial theory and history and the politics of empire, race, and knowledge production. She is currently writing a book on racial militarism, which utilizes a post-colonial framework to analyze the relationship between race, militarism, and the state in both imperial metropoles and post-colonies. Tonight's event format will be as follows. Following the lecture by Marwa, we will have a commentary and discussion by Jasmine. We will then end with audience question and answer. For those in the online audience, you will be able to submit your questions via the Q&A feature at the top left of your screen. When you do so, please let us know your name and your affiliation when submitting your questions. For those of you joining us in the theater this evening, I will let you know when they open the floor for questions, and then when you can raise your hand and wait for the microphone. I will then ask you to provide your name and affiliation before posing your questions, and the stewards will make their way towards you. I will seek to ensure a range of questions that, from our online audience as well as those who are in the theater this evening with us. For those of you on social media, the hashtag for today's event is hashtag LSEEvents. And please note that this event is being recorded and will hopefully be made available as a video and podcast, subject to no technical issues. But now I am delighted to hand over tonight's event to Marwa.
Thank you. I have a microphone to handle, so I'll try to manage all of that together. Good evening, everyone. Thank you all for being here tonight for this lecture. I want to start by first conveying my sincere thanks to Dr. Rohan Mukherjee, who's seated there, whose mail came to me a few months ago as a surprise, a beautiful surprise, and I want to thank you for the invitation. I know you manage these series, and I know that Dr. Ghani suggested my name, so I'm also thanking very much Jasmine, and I'll come to Jasmine in a little while as well. I want to thank also Nita Lumi for organizing all of this brilliantly since several months, and of course Dr. Jeffrey Schwieroth for chairing and for the very kind introduction. As for Dr. Ghani, as my discussant, I wouldn't have thought of anyone more suitable, and I'm very honored to have her as my discussant. Not only was she Fred Halliday's last PhD student, if I'm not mistaken, but she's also a very renowned scholar of anti-colonial theory and history, the politics of empire, race, and knowledge production, which have increasingly opened the field to these very difficult topics when it comes to international relations, and which have tremendously inspired my own research. So I'm very, very proud to have you as my discussant. And first also, I'd like to say how pleased I am to be back at LSE. I came here 10 years ago, actually 11 years ago, on a sabbatical leave from Georgetown University to work on my last book. So that was a very inspiring journey, and it's very nice to come here as I'm working on my current book. I also had my first book talk held at the Melis Center with Professor Michael Mason, who was director of the Melis Center, and that was my first book talk on the book that I had just finished 6 years ago. So I have very good memories of being here. It's also a tremendous honor, and I want to reiterate that, to be here on the occasion of this annual lecture commemorating Fred Halliday's immense impact on the field of international relations, but I would say also Middle East studies and Arab studies, and also another honor, double honor, to be here on the occasion of his 80th birthday. He's known for his major contributions to the field of international relations, bringing a very needed critical perspective, centering justice and human rights with a focus on the Arab world, which he labeled as the least understood region in international relations, and also his interest in always the understudied countries in the region, Yemen, for example, which hasn't really, at the time, didn't trigger a lot of interest on the part of scholars and researchers. He also wrote a very important book on the international relations of the Middle East, which more than 20 years after its publication is still assigned in a lot of the introduction to international relations courses. I assign it to my students because it really brings theoretical frameworks with a knowledge of the region as well. And that book, that trajectory, resonates with, as we know, the roots of the field of international relations. And I want to spend just 1 minute talking about that to see how he early on also shed a very important light on these roots. Roots of exclusion, systemic levels of exclusion, the racialized context of the founding myth of the discipline of international relations. Born in the context of a white empire with claims of false universalism during the 1919 Paris Conference, its very first act was to exclude. It was also blind to race, the discipline as a whole, and coloniality, racism, violence were the normative bases of the discipline, the structuring force, not merely resulting from power structures, but systemic levels of exclusion, silenced voices and subjects through global racial hierarchies and colonial legacies, what Dubois called the global color line. In this context, Fred Halliday urged us to refute the idea that the Arab world and the region, more broadly, was different from the rest of the world, that it was locked in unfinished wars, that it had economic failure, protracted economic failure, or cultural clashes, an idea which unfortunately is not only outside of the region, sometimes internalized within the region as well. He pushed IR analysts to reflect and recognize the impact of the global context and external influence and ongoing inequality of power on developments in the region. He has also so aptly shown and argued that colonialism, Cold War rivalries, and post-Cold War interventions have shaped state behavior, borders, and conflict, particularly in the Arab world. and in opposition to mainstream narratives in international relations that have often obscured the violent processes of dispossession, racialized domination, and extractive economies that produce the contemporary configuration of global inequality and continue to produce them, he has early on shed light on these structures. Building on this legacy, which I'm deeply honored to be in conversation with, I would like today to tell you a story, a similar story. A story, sadly, about domination, about dispossession, about genocide and ecocide, about famines, but also a story of resistance, agency, and hope. Climate ecological injustice is practically and ideologically inseparable from historical legacies of imperialism, colonialism, and capitalism. This is the overarching framework of my talk today and also my book project, which I call The Coloniality of Vulnerabilities. The conceptual map, actually, and I will guide you through the different boxes throughout my discussion. European colonial expansion across Africa, Asia, and the Americas, and specifically in the Arab world, transformed land, labor, and natural resources into possessable commodities available for extraction and profit without regard for indigenous ecologies. Imperial powers accumulated wealth through the violent extraction of these resources and labor from the colonized territories, which in turn enabled industrialization and the rise of fossil fuel economies across Europe and North America. These colonial projects reorganized ecological systems through plantation agriculture, mineral extraction, deforestation, and the mass exploitation of bodies and environments, thereby integrating these territories into capitalist circuits of accumulation. Capitalism, in turn, has further intensified the ecological degradation wrought by colonialism through its structural imperative toward perpetual economic growth, resource extraction, and the expansion of global markets without regard for ecological limits. Climate injustice becomes the ecological culmination of an unfinished project of empire structured by enduring racial hierarchies and reinforced through epistemic violence, which is the last box, which I will come to later on. This entanglement of colonialism, capitalism, and environmental exploitation has shaped the modern global order in ways that continue to structure inequality. So we're going back to the roots, to the history, to understand today's world. And allow me now to clarify some of these concepts, and I will present some case studies as I move along. The term coloniality of power inequality is taken from the great Peruvian sociologist Aníbal Quijano, who mentioned, actually looked into the enduring structures. He defined it as the enduring structures of domination that emerge with European colonial expansion and that continue, as I said, to shape global political, economic, and epistemological system. Through this formulation of the coloniality of power, Quijano has demonstrated how Eurocentered colonialism has been foundational in predicating on the invalidation of indigenous epistemologies and life worlds. In Quijano's framework, colonialism constitutes the historical period of European domination, whereas coloniality, which has inspired my own title, Coloniality of Vulnerabilities, refers to the ongoing logic and structure of domination that outlives colonial administrations and remains embedded in modern institutions, education, economics, and social hierarchies, also within the Arab world. The inequalities, but also the systems and policies aimed at their redress are profoundly impacted. The existence of this system required violence on a massive scale. Entire populations were displaced, enslaved, or eliminated in order to construct the modern global hierarchies. Race became central, the central axis through which global labor and power were organized. It also explains why challenges to these structures often encounter profound difficulty when confronting institutions of power. They are not merely confronting governments and corporations. They are confronting a historical order that has naturalized inequality itself. And of course, in that framework, And if I want to think about the coloniality of vulnerabilities, capitalism and colonialism and imperialism become co-constitutive. And they are also very well captured by the concept of capitalocene, which I will come to in a little while. Let me first discuss the different terms and how they intertwine. Imperialism, which expands capitalism geographically, refers to the process by which a political power extends its sphere of influence beyond its existing borders through physical force, political control, economic domination, diplomatic pressure, coercion, and/or cultural influence. In his 1977 essay on the intellectual origins of imperialism and Zionism, Said defined the principal characteristics of white European imperialism as, I quote, first, territorial expansion, second, will to power over other societies, third, classification of all nature and mankind into scientifically ethnocentric discrete categories of advanced and backward, developed and underdeveloped, normal and delinquent, superior and inferior mentalities, societies, languages, species. And four, the rationalization of all of these into juridical, territorial, racial, and social doctrines whose purpose was to cover outright conquest with a cloak of scientific and even humanitarian decency, end of quote. The latter two of these characteristics bear particular relevance to climate insecurity. Classification, division, and governance are central tenets not only of imperial governance, but climate and migration policy as well. Turning to colonialism now, it's best understood as the material and administrative manifestation of imperial ambitions. Frantz Fanon argued that colonial domination operates by destroying both the material and the historical foundations of colonized societies, producing a world in which the colonized must navigate systems designed for their exclusion. Let's ponder about that sentence. I think it's very, very important in the current context. Colonialism appropriates imperial desires, unrestricted access to land, labor, and resources, and translates them into realities. Colonialism was designed to feed the desires of the imperial metropole without regard for ecological sustainability or indigenous futures. And Enlightenment philosophies and scientific racism, such as 19th century social Darwinism, helped legitimize land theft and reduce peoples and places to commodities available for domination and exploitation. Hence, the hierarchy structures political, social, cultural, class, race. Turning now to capitalism, it becomes the economic logic that has historically enabled and sustained imperial and colonial projects. It requires growth, extraction, accumulation. So colonialism has been predicated not only a material conquest, but also epistemic domination, as I mentioned, but as a system organized around private property, market exchange, wage labor, and the accumulation of capital, capitalism found in the colonies the raw substrates, land, minerals, labor, and captive markets necessary for sustained expansion. The capitalist and imperialist colonialist imperative of profit and growth remade extraction into routine policy and ecological transformation into economic strategy. Land was cleared for cash crops, rivers were redirected for irrigation, entire ecologies were reorganized to maximize yields and surpluses. Capitalism thus legitimized dispossession through legal, scientific, and moral discourses that celebrated progress and modernity while concealing histories of violence and coercion. And finally, the added chapter to that whole framework, epistemic domination, or as Spivak referred to, epistemic violence. Coloniality of power operates not only through political economy, but through what could be described as cognitive violence. Knowledge itself becomes reorganized. Lived experience is translated into categories, into data, into systems that can be measured, tracked, and predicted. Nature becomes data. Human lives becomes data. Landscapes, bodies, and entire societies are converted into informational units that can be optimized for extraction and governance. This is not merely a technological transformation. it is an epistemological one. The result, of course, is an enduring subjugation, domination, and vulnerability, vulnerability being at the heart of my analysis about climate injustices. And of course, I didn't put in that, I will at the end with resistance, the meaning, what could be resistance, what is the meaning of justice in that overall overwhelming framework. But first, let's go back to the roots, the historical, the violent historical process. If we look at imperialism and colonialism, the co-constitutive nature of colonialism, capitalism, and environmental injustice demands a historical approach to the present planetary climate crisis, one that foregrounds the multivalent and enduring nature of empire. Between the 16th and 19th centuries, the indigenous population of the Americas declined by as much as 90% following European conquest, a demographic collapse that historians such as David Stannard have described as one of the greatest genocides in recorded history. The contemporary distribution of climate vulnerability reflects these enduring inequalities introduced by colonialism. Actors historically subjected to imperial domination contribute today the least to global greenhouse gas emissions, consumption patterns, and unsustainable practices, while suffering disproportionately from the social, economic, and ecological consequences of climate crisis. Anthropogenic narratives fail utterly to account for these historical processes. They have dominated climate discourse since atmospheric chemist Paul Crutzen popularized the term at the turn of the 21st century. Derived from the Greek anthropo, human, and sene, new or recent, the Anthropocene refers to a geological epoch in which human activity is the dominant force of planetary change. The concept of the Capitalocene offers an alternative interpretation. Introduced by historian Jason Moore, it emphasizes that the ecological crisis emerges not from humanity in general, but from the specific dynamics of capitalist accumulation. He argues, aptly and convincingly, that capitalism reorganized the relationship between humans and the web of life, transforming nature into a reservoir of cheap, so-called cheap inputs that could be exploited indefinitely. Whereas the Anthropocene assigns culpability for the present ecological epoch to, quote-unquote, humanity as an undifferentiated whole, the Capitalocene accounts for the co-constitutive forces of colonialism and capitalism in creating modern conditions. The Colombian conquest of the Americas and the subsequent rupture of existing land relations inaugurated a new geological age designed to sustain the capitalist world order. Beginning in the so-called long 16th century, 1450 to 1640, and continuing to the present, capitalism, as a way to organize nature, has demanded unfettered access to and exploitation of territories and bodies to function, a price disproportionately paid by racialized populations. Eurocentered colonization, justified through fictions like Manifest Destiny or Mission Civilisatrice, facilitated the appropriation and desecration of land and implementation of racialized taxonomies designed to support capitalist and imperialist visions, designs. Colonialism introduced a new world ecology that organized nature, as I mentioned, into so-called cheap nature. And he identifies four cheaps, which are very relevant when we think about climate injustices. Four cheaps that capitalist systems must control to sustain cycles of investment and production: labor, food, energy, and raw materials. To maintain continuous access to the four cheaps, capitalism must constantly expand into new frontiers of unused nature, so-called unused. In reality, territories are neither unused nor uninhabited. Expansion is euphemistic for the dispossession and disappearance of native populations. When labor becomes cheap, people who perform labor become cheap as well. Unlike earlier imperial systems, European colonialism transformed hierarchy into biology. Superiority and inferiority were no longer presented as political conditions, but as natural ones, embedded in race and civilization and culture. This transformation allowed domination to appear inevitable as part of modernity, as part of progress, rationality. And colonial domination became a biopolitical war. There's a very interesting research done by Amitav Ghosh on the Nutmeg's Curse showing this biopolitical and biological war, the expansion and conquest by the Dutch in the Bandas Islands, Indonesia in 17th century, which started as spice nutmeg trade and ended with the extermination of the Bandanese life. Enslavement and displacement of population to secure full exploitation of this lucrative local spice for the benefits of the Dutch Empire. It was one of also the first genocides and ecocides as part of that process. Within this framework, Europe positioned itself as the center of knowledge and authority. Lands beyond Europe were categorized according to their usefulness to imperial expansion. Territories deemed empty became sites for settlement and resource extraction. The late 19th century produced further devastation. Historian Mike Davis demonstrates in late Victorian Holocaust that between 30 and 50 million people died during the famine cycles across India, China, and Brazil in the 1870s and 1890s. However, and the deaths were attributed to drought and heat and scarcity, water scarcity. However, he shows that state violence and neglect created colonial markets and infrastructures, which combined with shifting weather patterns led to astonishingly brutal famines across the global south. These man-made famines happened in the time of colonialism in previously prosperous economies and countries. He coined it as the manufacturing of the third world, a very, I think, powerful and compelling way of describing it. The mismanagement of the drought by European imperial powers in those countries created a political ecology of famine. They were not natural disasters, they were man-made droughts. Interestingly, and the table shows you, these countries used to contribute about 20 to 25% to world GDP in the 1700, and we reached 1952 with a 5, 3, and barely 29, also Europe compared to 29% European contribution. Within this framework, scholars have also begun to emphasize the role of settler colonial expansion in transforming ecological systems. Different forms, always about land. Settler colonialism or settler empires, you could refer to them as well. Created forced sedentarization of nomads, repressive policies, and ongoing colonial relations and entitlements to the land. This perspective has sometimes been described as the settler scene, the capitalocene, but also the settler scene, emphasizing the ecological transformations that accompany settler colonial expansion, the transfer of settlers, resource capture, and alienation of local knowledge. Forests were cleared, rivers were redirected, landscapes were redesigned to replicate European agricultural systems. And the destruction of indigenous societies and the destruction of ecological balance occurred simultaneously. Settler colonialism, in that sense, is also related to environmental imaginaries and the coloniality of power. One striking example is the North Africa in the 19th century. Beginning in the mid-19th century, the French colonial government enacted land and forestry laws that favored European colonists at the expense of native Algerians. Driven by what Diana Davis refers to as modernist fables and fantasies about Roman North Africa, and the belief that Algeria was only 10% forested in contrast to the Roman ideal of 30%, this draconian code prioritized industrial production of cork and timber while criminalizing traditional subsistence uses such as grazing and gathering. Knowledge production by the so-called colonial riders created irreversible damage to the environment and to the indigenous populations. Under French colonial rule, Algeria's landscape was transformed through massive reforestation projects that introduced foreign species such as the Australian eucalyptus, a non-native species ill-adapted to local ecosystems. Settlers such as François Trottier, colloquially known as the Apostle of Eucalyptus, believed that planting millions of trees would not only serve the capitalist imperative of timber production, but would also transform the climate by bringing back the rains. By the late 1870s, 4 million eucalyptus trees had been planted in the colony. And at the same time, colonialists expanded viticulture and wheat cultivation with the aim of recreating the so-called abundant granary of Rome. And we see in the pictures also the narratives about thirsty Algeria and the people being dying from water scarcity, and also this imaginary about the Roman, the glorious Roman past. Even after political independence, Algeria continued legacies of extractivism. The former colonies in general remain positioned as extractive zones. And often there's a responsibility also in the post-colonial state in over-exploiting nature, doing land grabs, irrigation, and soil exploitation. The transition to a politically independent Algerian state in 1962 failed to translate into a total reversal of colonial environmental imaginaries. The post-colonial state often emulated and reproduced French colonial tactics. Mirroring Nasserist Egypt, Algeria kept the hydro-civilizational mission, the belief that the state's power is innately tied to its ability to control water resources, central to its national development strategy. This approach, inherited from the French colonial period, prioritized large-scale engineering and infrastructural development over pre-colonial forms of environmental management, with the extraction of fossil fuels, which is creating, until today, resistance and rebellion in the south of Algeria against also French companies who come and do some fracking there. There were similar narratives in the 19th century on the Nile River. Layered imaginations of the Nile by Western travelers and who were praising local Egyptian modernist elites, and the Nile River being described as pristine and ruined nature open for exploitation. The English were seen as saviors of Egypt's irrigation, and they imagined a new Egypt through scientific knowledge, exploitation of the Nile, and the education of the fellahin. Hydraulic technical knowledge was also part of the game. There were also colonial racist depictions of people versus romanticized visions of the river and landscapes by those English travelers. Exotic description, but the Arabs were always the other, the black shadows, all in one homogeneous category by all the foreigner travelers, and the Nile became part of English imperial landscape. The settler colonial project in Libya, also fascist Libya, carried the same knowledge production, the same practices. Socio-ecological transfers and policies of environing in Libya that changed the landscape to match an Italian image. Colonization was synonymous with demographic colonization and agricultural colonization. If we turn to other parts in the Arab world, this potent political mythology served a similar purpose to manifest destiny with the Zionist narrative of making the desert bloom by equating Eurocentric models of progress and abundance with claims to sovereignty, as we will see in our next case. Palestine, both during the British Mandate period and under Israeli occupation, typifies the logics of environmental orientalism, technocratic state building, and the overarching logic of what has been termed the settler scene. During the Mandate era, 1918-1948, British authorities and Zionist organization co-produced a socio-ecological regime that sought to transform the physical, demographic, and discursive realities of the land. This project was not only about the management of natural resources, but was a fundamental instrument of colonial world making. During the Mandate period, water was utilized to justify displacement and settlement, delegitimize indigenous land claims, and enact a hydro-civilizational mission predicated on European ideals of productivity and modernization. Following the conclusion of World War I, the British government secured the mandate for Palestine, with the explicit, albeit contradictory, goal of facilitating a Jewish national home while protecting the so-called civil and religious rights of the existing population in the Balfour Declaration. By framing immigration as a question of economic and ecological limits rather than sovereignty or historical moral rights, the British effectively rendered Palestinian objections to colonization null. This technical turn forced the struggle for sovereignty into the realm of science. While mandate geologists often adhered to empirically situated knowledge that suggested scarce resources, Zionist geophysicists deployed speculative and deductive methods to claim that vast, untapped aquifers lay beneath the surface. These so-called experts insisted that given sufficient capital, in most areas, water can be found. This thesis of abundance purported to prove the unlimited absorptive capacity of the land, thereby legitimizing unchecked immigration and the rapid expansion of settler colonies. British officials and Zionist settlers shared a technocratic imaginary similar to previous colonizers, 19th century and European colonizers, that categorized the indigenous Arab population as inferior, anti-modern and fatalistic, at once unwilling and incapable of improving the land. While mandate and Zionist authorities ideologically aligned in their racism towards Arabs, the British maintained a condescending view of the Jewish population, informed also by racial prejudice. However, the British nevertheless believed that the Jewish settlers possessed an innate tendency towards modernity, energy, capable of restorative engineering and European ideals of progress. They were somehow racially Asian, quote unquote, but nearly white. Conversely, indigenous Arab agricultural practices, which were often risk-averse, selective, and adapted to local rainfall patterns, were dismissed as primitive and wasteful owing to their childlike proclivities. While Arabs were removed to nearby hilltops and forced to relearn subsistence in dry, unsuitable environments, the appropriated land was allocated to water-reliant, capital-intensive Zionist settlers. These projects function as living laboratories where experts tested social and geographic engineering, turning indigenous land and resources into unsustainable settlerscapes. Following the 1948 Nakba, Zionist authorities found new ways of colonizing and weaponizing the Palestinian landscape. I'm referring here to the pictures about planting trees by the Jewish National Fund, which is always seen as an environmental ideal contributing to progress and modernity. And interestingly, I had the students in my class when we talked about that who said they went to Hebrew school every week, and they were taught that it was good to send money to plant trees in Palestine and later on Israel, and they didn't realize the historical roots, and it was a very interesting conversation to have with them about that history. The militarization of trees was the next move. Afforestation, first deforestation, and then afforestation on ruins. The Jewish National Fund militarized afforestation practices to sanitize the terrain of indigenous identity through co-constitutive policies of ecocide and memoricide. And Makdisi, Sari Makdisi, has documented extensively these practices in his last book. Replacing the biodiverse Mediterranean ecosystem with monocultural pine and eucalyptus plantations, the settler state imposed a geography of denial designed to mediate between the settler's ex-European eye and the environmental reality, also reproducing imagined biblical landscapes. Analytically, afforestation campaign manifests in the creation of what he refers to as scripted spaces, carefully curated environments that seduce the observer into a fiction of ecological redemption and prosperity. At the same time, this literal greenwashing through the creation of national parks on destroyed villages, Palestinian villages, which were either exterminated or expulsed, similarly, interestingly, to the national parks in the USA, which have often been developed on Native American land. They efface physical markers of indigenous presence by burying the ruins of villages destroyed during Israel's violent campaigns. But the pine tree provides a salient metaphor. Recent forest fires in the region, driven by a highly flammable resin in this non-native species, exacerbated by the Mediterranean's arid climate, give obvious lie to the notion of settler indigeneity. More recently, these practices have been expanded into what can be coined as contemporary manifestations of ecocide in Gaza and South Lebanon.
Hi, I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
Alongside the genocide that happened in Gaza since 1923, which has killed more than 73,000 Palestinians officially recognized, and we know there might be more than 300,000 under the rubbles, and amongst which like 17,000 women and children. Gaza is home now to the largest number of amputee children in modern history, and there was deliberate targeting. As we know, the ICC recognized that it's plausible that genocidal act has happened. Alongside also a campaign of ecocide, the destruction of land, life, livelihood, and futures, which reminds us of previous and past practices of colonizers. How do we define the ecocide? Well, it's committed with the knowledge that they are likely to cause widespread, long-term, and severe damage to the natural environment. And I'm quoting here the UCLA School of Law proposed definition of ecocide. Destruction or despoliation of natural habitats, ecosystems, or natural heritage, introducing harmful quantities of substances or energy into the air, water, or soil. And also any other acts of a similar character likely to cause an ecological disaster. Today we know that Gaza is strewn with more than 40 million tons of debris and hazardous material, much of it containing human remains. By early 2024, a significant portion of Gaza's farmland had already been decimated, with orchards, greenhouses, and vital crops wiped out by relentless bombardment. Olive groves and farms have been reduced to packed earth, and munitions and toxins contaminate soil and groundwater. Meanwhile, Gaza seawater is choked with sewage and waste due to Israel's cutting off of electricity to power and its destruction of treatment plants. If I move on to other cases, there are also recently new forms of colonialism, namely what we can refer to as green colonialism. So positive forms of green development, green energy, which are colonialism in disguise. If we look to green colonialism, it's the same principle of land theft, land grabs, under the so-called like progressive positive label of green energy and green development. Another example is the occupied Syrian Jolan or Golan. Manifestations of empire reborn are happening now on occupied land or through these new forms of green colonialism. Some have referred to it as eco-normalization as well in the context of settler colonialism. Since Israel occupied the Syrian Golan Heights in 1967, they have adopted policies over the water that can be traced back to a series of orders and laws that forbid any water-related work without the permission of the Israeli military. In the recent years, Israel has actively explored new avenues for alternative energy production in its occupied territories. Playing into progressive climate discourses, Israel has used a number of projects, including water, agriculture, oil and gas, ecotourism through national parks as well, and wind energy to cement its occupation in collaboration with the private sector. The damage to the Jolani agricultural sector is not only a product of water policies, it's also Israel's territorial expansion has displaced Jolani families and farmers from their traditional lands. whereas until 1967, almost two-thirds of the Jolani population relied on agriculture as their main source of income, less than 1% of these families are able to solely rely on farming today. The occupied Golan has received considerable attention for its contribution to Israel's carbon emission reduction targets. Airflow in the Golan is ideal for generating wind-powered electricity. And in 2014, the Israeli government established a self-imposed quota for 17% of its energy to be produced by renewable energies sources by 2030. It has invested in wind energy technology since the 1990s. One of the most notable projects has been led by an Israeli energy firm, Energix, which has pushed for a new wind turbine project in the occupied Golan. The project is to build a 25-turbine wind farm on the agricultural lands of the destroyed and depopulated Syrian villages that have been occupied since 1967. Farmland around the turbine sites would have to be cleared and intrusive roads built. In addition, as I mentioned, ecotourism, there were also the idea of having ecotourism happening in the occupied Golan with the administration of national parks again. I want to mention another case, similar practices in the occupied Western Sahara as well. Greenwashing and having projects of wind production and renewable energy being happening through foreign companies and corporations on occupied land, and showing here a picture by local Sahrawis asking Siemens to get out of the occupied land. Another example that I would like to also highlight in that colonial project is the new scramble for land grabs in Africa. We've known that because of food insecurity, increased water scarcity, a lot of the states, the Arab Gulf states, are leasing land in Africa, which a lot of the analysts would refer to as land grabs, because that lease is not benefiting local economies. The food produced is completely repatriated to the metropole, and the labor is exploited, and there's no benefit. So another form under disguise, because it could be looked at as a form of cooperation or trade or investments in Africa. Again, this is about control and exploitation by foreign actors. If I have time, do I still have time to talk maybe? I wanted to talk about also, we talked about north-south also, like, I mean, clearly here the UAE, Saudi Arabia are the actors from the south who are exploiting other southern actors. There's also a dynamic which is of interest here, which goes back to my first slide about control and domination when it comes to authoritarian regimes and through neoliberal reforms. And I'll quickly talk about the Syrian case if I have time. In Syria, the control and domination of the environment came through authoritarian liberalization. And you see here how political ideologies have shifted over the years. This is part of my last book, where I looked at ideology as a driver of vulnerability and insecurity. And it's about Ba'athism, and it's about socialism and green revolutions, but it's mainly about neoliberal reforms, which have happened actually since the 1990s, not only since Bashar al-Assad came to power. They had profound impacts on rural populations, on land management. At the time of drought, a very severe drought in 2006-2010, creating this myth that the revolution in Syria was created by climate change. It was not climate change, it was the mismanagement of climate change, the mismanagement of the drought, which brought actually a lot of vulnerabilities, which I identified as human, environmental, climate insecurity in Syria, the environment being one of them, and of course, political factors, economic security, unemployment, cascading impacts, displacement, the uprooting of whole communities when the subsidies were removed by the Syrian government at the worst time, at the peak of the drought, because of the neoliberal reform, the focus on urban centers versus rural centers, and how ideology was also framing all of that under the auspices also of international financial institutions. By applying the HECS framework to Syria, I realized that there had been much more severe droughts in the past. For example, the 1998-2001 drought had been much more severe in Syria. It did not create a revolution. Why did the 2006? Because we had the mismanagement, because we had the sudden lifting of subsidies to the rural communities when they needed the most the support. And of course, the cascading impacts that I'm showing here, employment, contribution of agriculture, unemployment, poverty, creating the conditions, the social material conditions for displacement and discontent. But it's not about climate change again. And I will end here about resistance and climate justice. How can we turn against the doom and gloom, the historical legacies, the very depressing picture that I depicted today, but it's realistic. I think, should we think about world ecological reconstruction? Should we think about intersectionality, an approach as a way to address inequalities, the asymmetric power relations experienced by individuals and groups, but particularly indigenous people by corporations and governments? Compounding forms of oppression arising from different combinations of race, class, gender, and which are all co-constitutive as well. It requires, and here I want to quote Dr. Ghani when she advocates for decolonial theory and practice, it requires courage and creativity to adopt a racial decolonial lens, and the role of anti-colonialism, post-colonial nations and identities matter here. Justice means also getting back the land, justice done by people who document violence, indigenous witnesses, the permission to narrate what is happening to them, but also the indigeneity of knowledge production. So climate justice is a theory across disciplines, but it's also a praxis of justice. The indigenous and local practices of adaptation are happening. If you think about the Jolan, and Dr. Dajani has worked extensively on the Jolan, showing how they have resisted the colonization. They're keeping their local traditional practices as very active forms, peaceful, active forms of resistance to the dispossession, the green colonialism. In the West Bank, in Palestine, the restoration of native seeds is a way also for local farmers to restore their access and their sovereignty, and also their history and their legacy with the land. The way forward, I don't have the solution, but I'm going to propose a few directions. Of course, the protection of the most vulnerable, the civilians, the women, the children, the migrants, who suffer the most on the impacts of climate change, wars, but also colonization, green or not. Agency and resistance of the most vulnerable, solidarity praxis of academics and activists, I think, as well, and also epistemological sites of struggle to work on knowledge production, to work on the meaning of all of this praxis is very important, and bring decolonization and indigenous knowledge to the table. And finally, it's about imagining new maps. We can imagine new maps, geographical, intellectual, moral, and ethical, to bring about just transitions, restore the silenced voices, and the protected continuation of empire, the title of today's talk, and have possibly a more hopeful future. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Dr. Marwa Daoudi, for such a rich lecture that connects and makes sense of multiple contemporary crises that we're seeing both globally and in the Middle East. Thank you also for your entirely unexpected but very kind comments at the start of your talk, but that really marks out Marwa's generosity as both a scholar and a person.
True.
It's a really hard job to offer discussant comments when a talk has been as comprehensive as the one you've delivered. I'm just going to offer, therefore, a few additional reflections that build on your talk, and we'll end with a couple of questions to ponder on. Perhaps some of them don't have immediate answers as well. But firstly, given that this would have been, as you mentioned, Fred Halliday's 80th birthday, it's very fitting that the themes in your talk and your analytical approach, I think, seem to be very much in the spirit of Fred's work and legacy. I can very much imagine him both agreeing, pushing back, debating with some of the ideas that you raised in your lecture in a very productive way. And he was very much opposed to thematic silos in the discipline. As far back as the mid-1980s, when I think it's fair to say that environmental politics was still on the periphery of IR concerns, Fred was writing about its importance on a regional and global level. In 1992, in response to Francis Fukuyama's triumphalism in his end of history thesis, Fred wrote in Critique, "The difficulties that ecology and feminism pose for his argument, the former by intimating catastrophe and man-made catastrophe at that, the latter by suggesting a quite other history with which liberal democracy does not engage, are not in any substantial way confronted." He was never afraid to engage and demand an engagement from others with topics that were considered unfashionable or even irrelevant, as they were at the time. And of course, Marwa, you've been working on environmental politics, and particularly in relation to the Middle East, for decades, and within IR. When I remember, it was largely left to political geographers working on the region, who did a very good job as well, but particularly in IR. And you've played a key role in putting environmental politics front and centre in Middle East studies within IR. In particular, your work is distinct because you avoid the siloing of the environment and ecology into international political economy or institutional politics, and firmly locate it in the political and historical. Speaking of the Middle East in particular, Fred Halliday was, of course, an intellectual giant when it came to empirical and historical expertise of the region, but he was also a serious, provocative theorist, often ahead of his time. He fundamentally resisted this separation between area studies and IR theory. He challenged the idea that theorizing is done in abstraction from the real world, and that regional expertise exists for the sake of providing the data for the theory, and often selectively at that. Instead, he showed the importance of cultivating first deep knowledge of a region as a necessary foundation for empirically informed theorizing. And again, I think your lecture today, but also your compendium of work over the years, has always done that, where your work is legible and important to both regionalists and theorists. Finally, Fred always emphasized the need to situate the Middle East within global politics and history, not detached from, not exceptional to, not merely impacted by, but actually crucial to shaping the global and the international. The global connections between histories, ideas, systems, and infrastructures was characteristic of Fred Halliday's work. And so to bring this back to your lecture, you also demonstrate this fundamental and necessary resistance to parochialism and segmentation. It's hard to think of two processes more salient to the notion of the global than A, ecology and the environment, by their very physical nature, transcending borders, and B, imperialism, forcibly transgressing borders. While both subjects seem very obviously central to understanding the Middle East, I would say for a long time, and I wonder if you'd agree with this, certainly until about 15 years ago or even until a decade ago, in IR at least, these two issues were still treated quite peripherally, apart from some notable exceptions in the field, you included. The emphasis on interstate conflict or domestic politics, especially after the Arab uprisings, often dominated research agendas or approaches even to teaching the Middle East. Actually, for a long time, addressing colonialism and empire, not as the only factor, but still central to understanding the Middle East, was actually seen as either too ideological or too historically deterministic. So I'd be really interested to hear from you what do you think has facilitated some change in that? And you referred to indigenous scholarship, which I think has played a crucial part, but what has made it more permissive to be able to draw those connections with colonialism and Middle East studies in particular? Of course, in fact, to imagine the region and the metropoles as not continually affected, admittedly in complex ways, but continually affected by colonialism is an ahistorical position. But also, as you eloquently showed in your talk, colonialism mutates and takes many new or rehabilitated or hybrid forms, and therefore is very much not just a historical variable, but a contemporary structural condition. There are two types of critiques of decolonial or post-colonial work. Of course, they have their differences. There are two types of critique in particular that I've come across that warrant engaging with. Right? One is a bit stuck on Edward Said's Orientalism, though he himself moved beyond that. And its focus on discursive constructions. I mean, he was a literary and linguistic scholar, so naturally he was focused on that. But even he conceded that his work at times produced binaries, and he sought in some of his subsequent work to disrupt that. A second interesting critique, and interestingly, more recently, coming from a sort of a growing genre, which is historical IR, has been that decolonial scholarship romanticizes the pre-colonial past. So obviously, it's very good to avoid that trap for the sake of analytical rigor. But I do think some of these critiques miss the totality of work that engages with the colonial. I think your lecture, along with the multiplicity of works that engage with concepts like coloniality, resist the aforementioned charges. You traced the material and the structural substance of coloniality in detail, and you do so in your other works as well. And you don't absolve the region's native and complicit actors. But I wonder, and here is one of the questions I want to pose, how you'd respond to some of those critiques. How much does the political system in any given country, and we're talking about the Middle East particularly here, could apply to other regions, to what extent does a political system in any given country exacerbate or disrupt historical patterns of colonial extraction? At what point do they, should they, displace imperialism in our analysis as a primary agent of responsibility for today's ecological disasters? Even if we think historically, you referenced the Arab Gulf states, and of course, huge levels of oil speculation extraction that began in the 1930s via the United States, but that wouldn't have been possible. The setting up of Aramco wouldn't have been possible without the complicity and at times invitation of the Arab leaders in those Gulf states, which explains as well why there is such a symbiosis between Western support for some of those regimes and, despite even often popular opposition, continued investment in those alliances by those Arab leaders? Or is this an unnecessary either-or? Relatedly, what I found really interesting in your talk was that the correlation, certainly causation, between ecological degradation and regime type at times seemed minimal, if not negligible, i.e. democratization is unlikely to reverse this pattern of ecological damage. You had examples of high capitalists and extractors among both democratic and authoritarian states. Meanwhile, on a global level, there are examples of highly centralized states with closed political systems that are taking climate disaster and renewable energy more seriously. But additionally, environmental policies themselves contain dualities. And again, from the examples you gave, it's possible for governments to be apparently highly invested in renewable energy and reforestation, primarily because it makes economic sense, but also for prestige and considerations of identity, while still being absolutely complicit in resource extraction and territorial annexation. And this reminded me of Adam Haniyeh's work, but also more recently, a young scholar, Palestinian scholar, Rada Sasser's work, in which the stories that states tell about, I quote unquote, green transitions are often myths, because renewable energy use is often not replacing fossil fuels, but merely adding to them. So my next question is, how would you reassess the much-cited Michael Ross thesis that oil hinders democracy? And I know that your talk didn't focus as much on energy, but rather eco-capitalism in other forms. So is there a distinction to be made between the two? or actually are they following similar dynamics? Is that relationship between oil and political systems more of a historical legacy from earlier stages of industrialization of those states, but less salient now? And my final question or slash reflection is about the role of the United States. The role of the US in all of this, on a day in which Trump has issued yet another one of his statements, whether we see it as really reflecting a future policy or not, I think we still nevertheless need to take what he says seriously as forms of normalization of these dynamics of colonialism, in which he argued that he is going to take over the resources of Iran and take over important geoeconomic sites of Iran. So is the future of climate justice inseparable from the future of the United States? Even if we are now in a multipolar, or some have coined multiplex order now, the US is arguably still the largest, most active, many would say aggressive economic power. Its capitalism and militarism still underpins and drives much of the economy and politics in the Arab world, either through trading patterns or through coercion. So will, for example, the US-Israeli war on Iran and the growing perception among the Gulf states that the US is an unreliable ally as a result loosen the US's economic foothold in the future? And does that open any future possibility for alternative policies in the Arab region that do seriously grapple with the unfolding regional and global ecological disasters that you laid out in your talk? Once again, thank you so much for such a rich lecture and look forward to your further comments.
Thank you very much, Jasmine. That was excellent. So much, you've put so much on the table. I'll try to organize my thoughts and address as much as possible to honor also the depth of your comments. And if I forget some aspects, just please remind me. The siloing of IR and area studies, I think, is a very important discussion. And you know, as IR scholars who work on the Arab world and the Middle East, there's always this sort of hierarchy that area studies is always inferior to IR theory, to models, predictions, etc., and they just come as a reservoir of data. But actually, you have IR theorists who could write about the Middle East, not speaking the language, not having done field work, as you know, which is an aberration, right? Because we are talking about specific state behaviors, patterns of domination, economics, etc. I think I started as an IR-trained scholar through environmental politics, becoming increasingly more interested in other disciplines and bringing them together in my research. And by working on water, it's about human geography, it's about political geography, it's about history. You have to go back to the history of the 19th century, Palestine, early 20th. You don't understand what is happening now. So I think it makes us as better theorists to be able to delve into these different, and I think I embrace interdisciplinarity. So I think the problem of the hierarchy that is put between area studies or IR and other disciplines, and if I recall correctly, Fred Halliday said, IR theory failed to predict a lot of the major developments and events like the fall of the Berlin Wall, the Lebanese Civil War, etc., because its predictive power is actually non-existent despite its claims. So I think the siloing is a problem. What I think is problematic also is the use of IR theory, area studies for intelligence or for state policies or state interest. And we know the history of Middle East studies in the US is a history of setting up experts to better dominate the region, to better deal with the region, or the same way anthropology historically was in Britain, a better way to know those indigenous societies to better dominate and conquer them as well. So there's a colonial aspect also to these disciplines that we can overcome as also scholars from the region. I think we can bring that knowledge, that history, that culture, and also have also theoretical contributions such as yourself. You write on race, on colonial, on decolonial power, on hegemony, from a theoretical perspective, but you need to bring also the knowledge from the field. So I think your first point, and I think Fred Halliday really discussed that very eloquently, and also being a critical voice on how IR can be framed as a very mainstream discipline. But we see increasingly now critical voices about the original sin of the discipline, right? Being a racist, being formed within a white empire, and clearly predicting or developing theory to prevent resistance, to increase hegemony, to increase the US power as well, or the Western power in that sense with the rest of the world. Your other point about the interdisciplinarity, the role of the climate justice, climate regime, and oil, and local states as well. I think there's I want to say something which I didn't mention here. There's a problem historically, but also in a lot of our disciplines, with determinism. And I mentioned social Darwinism. This created a lot of deterministic accounts in the 19th century, thinking because a country is landlocked or because a country is outside of the European sphere, it is deemed to be inferior. You know, those racialized theories. There is an increasingly also neo-Malthusian perspective, and as you know, in environmental politics over the last few years, which predicted and failed to predict actually, but theoretically predicted, because you have water scarcity in the Middle East, because there is like cultural clashes, according to that theory, these countries are doomed to be always at war. And water scarcity is a driver of war and conflict, protracted conflict. In the climate security field, we have a bit the same deterministic now drive, the same as this neo-Malthusian, because of population growth. The assumption is a lot of the countries in the south, because of population growth and water scarcity, will deplete the resources in the north and will create instability. So we need to contain these populations, right? In climate security now, the discussion is migration. It's become not population growth, it's become population mobility, which is seen as the potential threat for the global north, for the prosperity. So these deterministic approaches are very dangerous, I think, and they lie on colonial racist assumptions. Migrants who are mobile, who move around, who cross borders, are potential threats to the security and the prosperity of the global north as well. So I think we have to sort of disentangle these constructs, right? And when it comes to oil, I mean, Adam Haniyeh, you mentioned him, he really like rejects the rentier state theory, right? Meaning the production of oil, the discovery of oil, has determined the type of regime, the type of society, has created this type of authoritarian rule with rents being distributed for taming the population. He goes beyond it, right? He talks about insertion in the global capitalist system through oil, etc. Now, what we see, my point about green colonialism is, unfortunately, I don't think they will be cutting on their emissions, and they don't intend to do it. And if you have interviews with sometimes local experts or inhabitants, they will tell you this is existential, right? They quote, it's not water, we're talking about oil being existential. So there's this myth that without oil, there will be no survival for these states. So I think the renewable energy, the green energy, the land grabs are ways of diversifying, but not cutting down on these practices and the emissions will, I mean, there are intentions, of course, but I think these economies are deeply grounded, and there's also the mythology that comes around it that also defines the state, but not in a deterministic rentier state perspective. I think we can go around that and refine it a bit more when we think about those countries. Remind me about other points.
The US.
The US role, of course. Well, clearly, hegemony it's all about power, right? We're talking about power, we're talking about hegemony, we're talking about colonization. I mentioned a lot the European expansion because they used to be the drivers, no longer. Now it's about America as well. And when it comes to the Middle East, you mentioned the Israel-American war on Iran. Clearly, I don't think there's a vision there. I think there's a lot of short-term decisions being taken, rash decisions. We might be in a situation of no peace, a status quo, protected status quo, which is not peace, which is not resolved. I think there's a before and after when it comes to the U.S. and the election and the current leadership. The implications for the region are very, very profound, but I don't think only for the region, I think for the whole world. And one could argue, as you said, it's a multipolar world. The intention was to no longer have American hegemony, right? The idea of retrenchment, isolationism, etc. But then those rash decisions about launching war or conquering. You mentioned taking over land, right? We talked about Greenland, we heard about Greenland, we talked about taking over Venezuela's oil. These are reminiscent of colonial practices, clearly. Very much reminiscent. I mean, everything, the language that I've described is about taking over resource, land, people, right? Making them cheap, accessible, disposable, to the benefit of the colonizer. And so there's a possibility now that we're moving, but it's not the same label, right? Colonization has a bad image to it. It's framed differently. It's aimed for security, for prosperity, for democracy. And I believe the liberal jargon is as dangerous as the colonial jargon. In the end, the result will be the same dispossession, instability, insecurity for those concerned.
Right. Thanks, Marwa. Thanks, Jasmine, for the insightful comments and the discussion. It'd be great now if we could get some questions from our audience, both online and in person. For those of you that are online, please type your questions into the Q&A box, and I will try to get as many as possible. Those in the audience, raise your hand, and I'll select some questions. Please wait until the stewards come to you. Please state your name and your affiliation, if possible. Could we have one here and one over there?
Hello, Francesco Belcastro, the Montfort University. Thank you very much for a fascinating lecture. I was wondering if I could push a bit more on the case of Palestine and the connection to the theory. Now, it seems to me that it's clear that the trajectory that you're describing, it's, and the Palestine is almost kind of the clear example of that dynamic. And obviously, particularly for you, for someone who's a background in sort of water studies, none of this is entirely new, right? It's a more aggressive, more violent manifestation of things that Palestine has experienced for very long. But it seems to me that the ecocide that is happening at the same time as the genocide in Gaza and southern Lebanon are, in terms of scale of ecocide, something, at least in the context of Palestine in the last couple of decades, unprecedented. Now, if we go back almost backwards to the theoretical framework you started from, is that just an expression of this coloniality of power inequalities, so the settler colonial state can do whatever it wants? Or is it kind of a new stage? Is it a kind of big reshaping of the environment around that's got, it almost becomes more central to the political project than it was before? Thank you.
Thanks. Maybe we'll get one other question on the left over here as well.
Hello. Oh, this was actually turned on the whole time when I was having a conversation. First of all, thank you very much. I'm Dr. Dina Zaid, and I'm an independent consultant and researcher. This has felt very refreshing in comparison to the conversations that I've had today in some of the spaces that I travel in. So I sit in practitioner spaces, and with a one foot in research and one foot with working with philanthropy and in finance on climate issues. And to give you a sort of scale of the contrast and a bit of context for the question that I'm about to ask. I had a conversation earlier today with a philanthropic fund that has managed to raise over $500 million dollars in a very short span of time, with a really complex techno-engineering plan for sea level rise, tackling sea level rise that doesn't have much consideration for ecological or local realities in ways that I don't think would surprise you or would surprise me. And I ask this question in large part because I'm very interested not only in the siloization of fragments across disciplines, but how theory can inform some of these practice spaces in ways where, if we're voicing the concerns about the genesis and the histories of coloniality and thinking and interventions, we don't get branded as ideologues. So I think there's a real question of the practitioner reality to stop some of these discourses inside the belly of the beast, in the world of capitalism, in the world of finance, with ideas that are often, as you say, it's not the language of liberalism and progress. Climate resilience is a very strong intervention point in many of these cases. So I'm very curious what your advice would be on that practitioner end of the spectrum and how we bring theory to the world.
Thank you.
Should I start? Okay. Francesco's question, thank you. Are we in a new stage? I think what has changed is the fact of being able to refer to what is happening in Palestine as settler colonialism. And that goes back to your question, actually, Jasmine, about it's a new development to have IR theorists write about race as you do, right? And coloniality and knowledge production, which is much more part of anthropology, possibly post-colonial studies. But there's been a merging happening, and I think that has strengthened our analysis. And in the case of Palestine, I think it just revealed itself. Like, we know that it's been a settler colonial project all through, but it didn't like the label of settler colonial. Because when we think settler colonialism, we go back to Algeria, we go back to the French, we go back to 19th century real colonial power. And in modern times, modern states who are progressive, who are rational, don't like to be called settler colonial states. So it was under the disguise of occupation, which it is an occupation, but it is a settler colonial occupation. So I think there's been an acceleration, possibly. I think maybe 2023 brought this acceleration in the different phases of settler colonialism. And there's also been, that goes back to the issue of representation and language and all of that, there's suddenly not much care about how this is perceived because it's seen as acceptable and there's a momentum for doing it. And just looking at historical cases, you know, the Bandas case, 17th century, I was very struck by the way how it started with the trade over nutmeg and it came to the destruction completely, elimination of the local population and their enslavement. And I think at the time it was permissible, right, to do that. Today we assumed it's not permissible, but possibly because of the general, you know, the international configuration now, it is a new form which can be acceptable. The same way green colonialism is seen as acceptable. And that brings me to your question. It's true that as theorists we're able to conceptualize and call out and think about politics of representation, knowledge production, but I do think in terms of praxis, it's seeping into praxis. So Edward Said, for example, right? Like, we always go back to him, but he has contributed immensely to the fact of being able to deconstruct, look behind representation. What does the language of development mean? For example, you know, you're talking about philanthropy, but there's also development. A lot of that, and I had a section on development, is about also colonial practices. Right, like the way foreign institutions or foreign actors come and impose practices is a colonial project of development as well, although it doesn't have that label. As a practitioner, I would recommend, I think what we try to do as academics is to reach out to the policy world to have possibly publications which translate those theoretical, possibly academic books into hopefully something which is accessible to wider audiences. And I think that's what a lot of the, I mentioned Mike Davis, I'm a big fan of Mike Davis. He's really looked into archives, very complex history, made it very accessible to everyone. And it's a very gloomy picture, but very telling about how it happened with the pictures in the archives, the language. And I believe scholars could do that. It's to help practitioners. And you as a practitioner, I think the language of development being possibly biased, philanthropy being also scrutinized in terms of what is the agenda, how is it progress when indigenous people are being eliminated, what is the underlying root, what is the context, the historical context, and we tend sometimes with practitioners to just look at the moment, but having a historical analysis of the case, bringing local voices is an important way of restoring agency, I think, and it could be feasible without necessarily labeling things. It's by increasing the voices, by increasing also shedding light on the local reality versus the top-down external intervention. Could be a way of moving forward.
We'll take one from the online community, and then could we take this person on the right over here?
So first. So we have one from Tejal, who's a Year 12 student, and he's asking, to what extent do you think the impacts of ecological degradation can be erased, or are they too embedded into the post-colonial societies already?
Okay, thank you. And he's 12 years old?
He's from year 12,
which is college level, pre-university,
oh, okay,
high school,
okay.
17.
Yeah. You're 12 in the English system. Okay, first I thought he was 12 years old. I was like, wow, he's watching my lecture. My daughter is here and she's so bored.
Hello, my name is Francis Outram. I did my PhD with Fred Halliday on Oman. My question is perhaps I'd be interested in your sort of thoughts of looking forward. If oil was perhaps the commodity which came to define the global economy from the 1920s, and that was the way in which the new state system, which the European empires constructed in the Middle East, was one of its sort of main focus, part of which was the, and into the 70s, the sort of maintained, creating regimes in the Gulf states which would support that sort of extraction. As the world moves to a sort of so-called transition to a low carbon economy driven by the imperatives of a collapsing environment, what do you see in terms of the Arab Gulf states, in terms of, we talked about Rentier state and Adam Hania, you know, opposed that term, but in terms of regime survival, those states are very much, almost they generate as much wealth possibly from their sovereign wealth funds. And the way they've become integrated into sort of global capitalist circuits, I'd be interested in your thoughts on, as the world moves to this new form of technology which will require rare earths, how does this notion of a land grab for things like rare earths, or the Arab Gulf states of land grabs for food, how will they play that out in there and with their relationship with the core, as it were, in this sort of developing global economy, another next phase of the global economy, which in the end the fossil fuel is ultimately coming to end, although those Gulf states will try and stop its transition for as long as they can.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. So I'll start with the, can we reverse the impacts of ecological degradation? I think, you know, even the cases when we think about ecocide and we think about the toxic rubbles, you saw on the slide, like in Gaza, for example, 350 years to go back to pre-2023 levels. The level of destruction, but also the level of toxicity will take a lot of time. If there is a will to really clean up, I mean, we see Syria today. For 10, 15 years, the destruction of buildings created industrial, medical toxicity, also the unexploded ordinances. And I was writing, I remember at the time, before 2024, essays where I was very pessimistic, thinking there will be no way to restore the country the way it was, right? Like it's going to take, there are bids, there are contracts, people are taking them, they're not doing the cleaning, etc. Today there are efforts to do it. I think it's going to take time, and I think I'm an optimist. I talk a lot about like the doom and gloom, but I do believe in the power of regeneration when there is a possibility and when the communities are included in that. And I think when I look at Syria, there is a strong will to restore the country to where it was. So I do believe in the capacity. Now, when the land has been completely decimated and completely violated and contaminated, of course we have to think a bit differently. But I think bringing back the people and their access to the land, I think that what comes out of in the end, land is very important in all of that discussion, and restoring access to the land for the population is crucial. And once it's restored with the right means, I do believe in the capacity to reverse the impacts. But it doesn't mean that we have to continue doing what we're doing, because in the end it will happen. We have to stop what is happening, and in that sense, to be realistic in that sense. Oil craft now, the impact of oil. I'm not an expert on Arab Gulf states, but I want to look into a bit the history and the politics of the region. And of course, oil is a determinant of all of that. The creation, for example, of the Trucian states around oil, the role of external powers, the continuing alliance with these external powers. I mean, we saw with the Iran war now, how the alliance is being tested and what the US is doing, what the local actors are doing. I think there's an incentive in moving away if renewable energy, the rare minerals, all of that are potentially lucrative. And I think they are. They are becoming lucrative and they're becoming alternatives. But there is this, I don't know how to explain it, when you talk to people who are there, who have depended on oil, on this idea that the state would not survive, again, this idea of an existential threat. And if they move away from oil, they would lose regime survival, they would lose their livelihood, their way of life, their lived experience. And maybe there's a need for, and I believe the newer generations are thinking a bit differently. The ones who are environmentally also conscious, but also if they link the authoritarian and repressive regimes with the fact that we have that system, they're also contesting it. And you saw also what happened after 2023. The public opinion in the Arab Gulf states was very much against what Israel was doing in Gaza, even though the states and the governments were voicing different perspectives. So I think it's interesting, it's important to not think about them as monolithic entities. You have different diverse currents. Now, in terms of the global economy, there's clearly resistance to cutting emissions and to moving away, but there's also an interest in looking into other sectors. So possibly over time this might take over, but so far the main discussion after the Iran war was the price of oil. That's what people cared about, and I came from the US. What people care about, not that Iran is being bombed, not that South Lebanon is being bombed, is the fact that the gas, the tank is becoming very expensive. And this is what is hurting the current leadership. It's not launching an illegal war, it's the fact that the cost of life is becoming very expensive. And I think in the end, it just shows that oil is still very central, unfortunately.
Great. I'm afraid that's all the time we have now for questions. Those of you that still have questions or comments, I would invite you to engage with our speakers at the reception afterwards outside. For now, let me say it's been a great pleasure for myself and I think for those of you in the audience to listen to the discussion today. A big thank you to Marwa for joining us, for Jasmine for her questions and her commentary. Thank you for those in the audience, both here in person and online, particularly those of you that asked questions to our panel. We're very pleased that you could join us, and we very much hope that you can join us for future events at the LSE. Thank you very much, Andrew.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events Podcast on your favorite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.